Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Officials in Pakistan are saying the death toll from Saturday's earthquake in the mountains north of the country may double to at least 40,000 people, many victims thought to be children trapped in collapsed school buildings. The scope of the devastation has now prompted Pakistan to accept relief assistance from its rival India, where at least 865 people have died. Earlier today, India said Pakistan had turned down its offer of helicopters to reach remote areas, such as those in the disputed Kashmir region, where villages have been cut off by landslides, bad weather, and ruined roads. The U.S. is also sending 8 military helicopters and $50 million. Well, joining us on the line from the capital, Islamabad, is Marvin Pervez, regional director for the aid agency Church World Service. Marvin, how are people reacting to so many deaths?
The whole nation is in a very somber mood, and there are special prayer services taking place all over the country. There are people donating cash and in kind at different places. At Church World Service central office today also, we had a special prayer service for both the dead and the injured.
We understand that a couple of your workers lost their whole families.
Yes, at least one lost all his family, and another staff member lost uncles and aunts who were living in Kashmir. Some staff and their families also received injury.
So even international aid organizations have been hampered somewhat, by this. What are you trying to do? I mean, such an enormous catastrophe. What are you doing?
Robin, we actually pre-position relief items here in our regional offices. So on day one, 600 shelter kits and food baskets for 600 families were immediately moved, which are in the area and will be distributed tomorrow in coordination. But like you said, it is very difficult. Already we have had over 150 aftershocks, which really is hampering not only the aid community to get aid, but also people to go into safer shelters. But people are just refusing to go into. So tents are a very important and urgent thing right now, which Church World Service is shipping. And we, in the next week or so, will have at least 8,000 tents out there in the affected areas with the families.
Well, we understand that Pakistani troops with heavy lifting equipment have arrived in some of the remote regions today, but there was complaints from Pakistanis over the weekend that the government, that the military, wasn't doing enough quickly enough. Do you think that's fair, or do you think that this is just such a huge catastrophe, the worst quake in 100 years, and it would have been impossible to get there any sooner?
I think both the civilian authorities, the military, and the international aid community have been overwhelmed. In the remote areas, there are several villages which have just disappeared. There's so much death and destruction. And even if the military wants, it will be difficult to get into these hilly, mountainous villages. The access is almost difficult. And as you know, Saturday is also, at that time, was school time for government schools. Mm. So hundreds of children were in schools at the time when the quake hit. And there are still at least 1,000 children and elder and adults trapped in many school buildings across the northern areas.
Mm. And Marvin, before we let you go, I just wanted to ask, here in the U.S., we just watched horrible pictures of Americans struggling to get out of the wake of Hurricane Katrina. And we have to now multiply that by, thousands to try to grasp what's going on in Pakistan. How are you doing? It seems as if thousands of your fellow Pakistanis are entombed today.
Yes, we definitely, all the team, we were just having a debriefing session with the team, and we were talking about the images we are getting, and this definitely causes a lot of stress for aid providers like Church World Service. But we continue to meet every day. There's enormous need, and there's, what we can do maybe is very little, so that kind of frustration is there. And like I said, the children have suffered a lot, and I myself have three, so and I think every child that has suffered is like my child, and that's why I want to be at Churchill Service out there with the community, trying to, you know, do as much as we can.
Marvin Pervez, Regional Director in Pakistan and Afghanistan for the aid agency Church World Service. Well, turning to Columbus Day, over 500 years after the Italian explorer set foot in the Americas, school children are still reading that the people he discovered here sort of blended in with the landscape, barely making their mark on the earth. Some scholars now say those textbooks have to change.
One way to sum up the new scholarship is to say that it has begun, at last, to fill in one of the biggest blanks in history, the Western Hemisphere before 1492. It was, in the current view, a thriving, stunningly diverse place, a tumult of languages, trade, and culture, a region where tens of millions of people loved and hated and worshipped as people do everywhere. Much of this world vanished after Columbus, swept away by disease and subjugation. So thorough was the erasure that within a few generations, neither conqueror nor conquered knew that this world had existed. Now, though, it is returning to view. It seems incumbent on us to take a look.
That's author Charles Mann reading from his new book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Charles Mann is a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly and Science Magazine, and he joins us now to take a closer look in the studio. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
There is so much here. I was taken back to the last of the Mohicans in upstate New York, to Plymouth, the first Thanksgiving, to Mayan and Aztec ruins. We want to talk about it all, but first some ground rules, because you set them also in your book. As you note, Indian is a loaded word for many, but you choose to use it for clarity. Why is it loaded, and what would you prefer?
Well, Indian, I mean, we have to say, is a kind of a stupid name, because obviously the people we're talking about as Indians don't come from India. So
right.
It's a historical mistake.
Right, because Columbus thought that he had landed in Asia and India.
Right. Yeah. Now, in the 1960s, there was a proposal to replace that with Native Americans. And there's a couple problems with that. In its own way, that's just as problematic, because literally speaking, anybody who's born in this country is a Native American. I'm a Native American. Perhaps you're a Native mm-hmm. American. The other thing it does is erase the distinction between Indians, the people that lived here and in South America, and the peoples of the extreme far north, the Inuit and the Eskimo, who are a different group of people who came over later. And that kind of eliminates that distinction. And the third thing, as I learned when I was researching this book, is that Indians themselves don't call themselves Native Americans, at least none of the ones that I spoke to. And in Central and South America, the people there, the indigenous people there, when I would refer to them as Native Americans, they laughed at me and said, oh, no, those are just people north of the Rio Grande. We're Indians here. So with their ridicule ringing in my ears, I decided to use Indians in my book.
Right. And why did you decide to write the book?
Well, this has been an interest of mine for a long time, and it really started, I guess, in the early 1980s when I kind of by accident ended up in Yucatan and saw the Maya ruins and thought, wow, these are magnificent. Why didn't I know anything about them? And from time to time, I would try to arrange journalist reporting trips that would take me there, and I would get a chance to see some more. And I talked to various researchers along the way, and gradually I realized that the picture they had of what the Americas were like before Columbus was tremendously different from the picture that I had been taught in school. And then in the 1990s, my son started going to high school, and what he was taught was the same as what I had been taught, stuff that by now I knew was at least a generation out of date. And I thought, somebody ought to write a book.
Well, let's talk about some of that conventional wisdom that I learned as well in school. Remind us of what that is, the conventional wisdom about the Americas pre-Columbus.
Well, the basic thing that at least I was taught was that Indians walked across the Bering Straits about 12,000 years ago, that they lived for the most part in small scattered bands, except for maybe a couple places like Mexico City and Peru, and that they had so little impact on the environment that when Columbus landed, the Americas were, for all intents and purposes, a wilderness. And I guess one way to sum up the prevailing thinking now among researchers is to say that all three of these are now thought to be wrong.
Right. Tell us, what is the new thinking?
Indians were here for far longer than previously believed. They're here in much greater numbers, and far from being a wilderness, the Americas thoroughly bore the human mark, the human fingerprints all over of its original inhabitants.
As you write, they had thoroughly imposed their will on the landscape.
Yes.
And you describe some of these places, and if anyone has been lucky enough to see some of them, I've seen Tikal in Guatemala or Machu Picchu. Describe some of these footprints.
Well, I guess if you had been able to fly in a plane in, 1491, just before Columbus arrived, and you were flying from north to south, say starting from here in Boston, you would have flown along the coast of North America, and you would have seen almost the entire coast lined with farms and farming villages, some of them quite large, with the fields extending many miles inland. You would have seen wide open forests that had been kept open by burning, annual burning. If you flew during the fall, which was the burning season, you would see mile-long lines of flame. Then if you went to central Mexico, you would see in central Mexico what was then probably the world's most densely populated place, millions upon millions of people in very large cities. The city of Tenochtitlan, which is the capital of the Aztec Empire, was then population of on the order of 250,000 or so, which was larger than London or Paris. Mm-hmm. And similarly, you go into South America, you'd see the Inca Empire, many millions of people there, and an extraordinary expanse that stretched the equivalent from Stockholm to Cairo, with the world's largest highway network. And then even in the Amazon, where the whole ecosystem of the tropical forest was regulated and controlled to a large extent by human beings.
One thing we haven't mentioned that you found, yes, the Indians are now thought to have been here longer, in larger numbers, bigger populations, many in cities, as you said. They had thoroughly imposed their will on the landscape. But there's one other element. They had no immunity.
A quirk of history, the exact cause of which scientists are still arguing about, most of the large mammals in North and South America died about, on the order of 13,000, 14,000 years ago. And as a result, Native Americans, Indians, had almost no domesticated animals. And the reason that this played a role, in addition to obviously having an enormous impact on their societies, was that most of the terrible diseases of humankind come when humans and animals live in very close proximity over a long period of time, and animal diseases mutate, and scientists call it jump the species barrier. And thus, measles was originally a cow disease, bovine rinderpest, smallpox was either from horsepox or camelpox, depending which geneticist you talk to. Flu comes from birds. The list goes on and on. With no domesticated animals, Indians didn't have any of these, what they're called crowd diseases.
Yeah, was it Cortez that traveled with his pigs?
Yeah, no, it was
just running around the
horse. Yeah, most of the Spaniards traveled with pigs as kind of ambulatory meat lockers. What happened, though, is these diseases, they brought them inadvertently. So these diseases came, they hit this completely unprepared hemisphere, and people not only did not have natural immunity to them, but because they had so few epidemics of any sort in general, they didn't know anything about quarantine, and so somebody would get sick, friends and family would, come around them to comfort them, they would get infected, the whole village or town would get infected, and people would just run off, and in this way, the epidemic would radiate out like a string of firecrackers into the countryside, spreading far beyond the original place where Europeans landed. And so Europeans were constantly coming into places that had recently been emptied by these terrible diseases, well ahead of seeing any Europeans.
That's Charles Mann, author of the new book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus, just talking about how illness literally wiped them out. We're going to take a break, but after that we'll find out, before they were wiped out by the Europeans, what did the Indians think of the Europeans? Hint, not many Europeans took baths back then. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And on this Columbus Day, we're speaking with author Charles Mann about his new book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. And Charles, before the break, you were telling us how disease wiped out what was really a sophisticated Indian civilization before the Europeans arrived with their viruses. And because there's a missing record of this culture as well, the vacuum was filled by people's imaginations and their hopes for what Indians were like. One of those people here in New England who bought into some misconceptions was Henry David Thoreau.
Henry David Thoreau, extolled the wilderness as he saw it, saw it as being lost by the Europeans coming in, and sullying this wonderful place that had been maintained by Indians. And in fact, it was almost exactly the opposite in the sort of most brutal and ironic way you can imagine. The Indians thoroughly maintained that wilderness. They burned the undergrowth. It was wide open. And the reason that they did that was to encourage game, which they hunted. When they died from these epidemics sweeping through New England, which began just before the Pilgrims with an epidemic, probably of viral hepatitis that killed about 90% of the population of coastal New England, all this burning ceased. The landscape suddenly became overgrown and, quote, wild. And what happened was Europeans, instead of destroying wilderness, actually created it. And if he'd wanted this kind of Indian wisdom, he would have gone out and started burning immediately.
Well, but as you know, this has been one of the criticisms of your thinking and the thinking of others that you quote, that it really kind of messes with the heads of some environmentalists because, they even had Indians on billboards. The move of some parts of the environmental movement is to get back to the pristine landscape the way the Indians lived.
The problem with that, I think, is by and large, these people were impressive landscape managers who created landscapes that they wanted to live in. These are people who, shaped the places they wanted to live in for the future. And that's an orientation, I think, that the environmental movement could, take some cues from.
Yeah,
rather than trying to take us back to a past that didn't exist and that we can never possibly get to, let's think about what kind of place we want to live in and see if we can build it.
Your view would make more sense because, again, as you point out, Indians, in your take, would be a thriving, changing people, which would make sense. What people would remain static over thousands of years?
Right. And there's a thing I call Holmberg's mistake after an unfortunate researcher I pick on kind of unfairly, Alan Holmberg, and actually a wonderful anthropologist from Cornell. And he studied an area in Bolivia that I start off talking about, and he believes that the people who inhabited it were remnants of the Stone Age, people who had lived lives that had essentially unchanged since the Pleistocene era. And in fact, we now know that they had a rich, complicated history and that the people that he saw were as, very, very, quote, primitive, very, very simple lives, were people who had once been, much more sophisticated materially and had been terribly abused by people in Bolivia and in other parts of South America and were essentially a kind of refugee group.
Right, that he stumbled upon. And as you write, it would be like seeing someone stumbling out of a concentration camp and thinking that they depicted what the population was really like.
And had always been that way.
And yet this is a characterization that went into history. It formed some people's thoughts. I want to go to that sense that some people have of Native peoples, that they were dirty, savages. You have a beautiful passage where you describe what the Indians actually thought of the Europeans.
Well, this I'm describing is in the book is the way that the Indians of the Northeast, people speaking Algonquian and Iroquoian for the most part, regarded Europeans. And this would be recorded in European chronicles as they would talk, the Jesuits and so forth, as they would talk to the Indians. The Indians would let them know what they thought, and then the mm-hmm. Jesuits, in astonishment, would record the negative opinions that these Indians frequently held. Europeans, Indians told other Indians, were physically weak, sexually untrustworthy, atrociously ugly, and just plain smelly. The British and French, many of whom had not taken a bath in their entire lives, were amazed by the Indian interest in personal cleanliness. A Jesuit reported that the, quote, savages were disgusted by handkerchiefs, quote, they say, we place what is unclean in a fine white piece of linen and put it away in our pockets as something very precious, while they throw it upon the ground.
Further, the Puritans, as you write about them, who confronted the Indians that were here in the New England area, come off at best as buffoons.
Well, I have to say this was a bit of a shock for me, as I'm one of those people who can actually trace back his ancestry. And, my own ancestors, the Billingtons, one of the kids almost blew up the Mayflower and the other one promptly ran away. And they were kind of Their father was the first person, the second person hanged in New England, I think. So they didn't exactly have a sterling record. But what was extraordinary was that the Pilgrims landed in New England with no food, very little supplies at the beginning of winter, and really no clue as to how they're going to make their way. It's kind of amazing, given that only half of them died.
And without the indigenous Indians, who were ultimately wiped out in large part by the diseases that the Puritans brought, they would not have survived at all.
Right. The way they did it is, for the first few months, they subsisted in large part on the corn that they dug out of Indian graves and household stashes.
Charles Mann, there are so many stories within your story But I want to ask you one thing before we let you go. What do you think is going to happen with all this new thinking? I'm reading of some of the things that textbooks said about Indians as recently as 1987. Here's a standard high school textbook, American History, a Survey. It summed up Indian history thusly. For thousands of centuries, centuries in which human races were evolving, forming communities, and building the beginnings of national civilizations in Africa, Asia, and Europe, the continents we know as the Americas stood empty of mankind and its work. The story of Europeans in the New World, the book informs students, is the story of the creation of a civilization where none existed.
I don't think that you need to be, you know, a liberal apologist to think that it's a little strange that the history books are saying that human beings are evolving and changing everywhere on the planet except the Americas.
For thousands of years, they just sort of stood there.
Collected
berries, right?
I mean, it just isn't what people do. You know, we're a busy species. We're constantly doing stuff. And I have to say, as I've been, you know, traveling around the country, a lot of historians and history teachers have come up to me and have said, this is great. I didn't know this. This is wonderful. I'm going to have my students read this. So possibly this book is giving a little nudge to changing things.
Charles Mann, the book is called 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. It's a terrific read. Charles, thank you.
My pleasure.
And stay with us on this Columbus Day. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. Chinese immigrants of the early 20th century came to the U.S. in search of what they called Gold Mountain. But instead, many of them found themselves in a wooden cell. They were segregated and detained for years in a place called Angel Island as part of an American policy to keep Chinese laborers out of the U.S. This nearly forgotten chapter of American history is now coming to light thanks to a $50 million project that's restoring the Angel Island Immigration Center on San Francisco Bay. As reporter Hannah Baba tells us, the story of these immigrants still haunts that island in the form of delicate and disturbing poetry etched into prison walls.
On a clear day, the ferry ride to Angel Island is a soothing experience. With majestic views of the Golden Gate Bridge, the island's lush greenery, and the sun's rays glistening off the bay waters. Alex Weiss was a ranger here at Angel Island State Park in 1970. One day, he wandered into one of the old buildings on the island that was scheduled for demolition that year. It used to be an army barracks, as far as he knew. The Guardian of the Western Gates, they called it. He was walking through the run-down barracks with his flashlight when he noticed something on the walls.
And I came through and I saw these calligraphy, Chinese carvings on the wall. And I said, wow, that's pretty impressive. And then I kept going into this main room, which was a dormitory for Chinese detainees, and noticed that the entire walls were covered with calligraphy.
It turned out Weiss had stumbled upon a secret hidden for decades. It wasn't just calligraphy. It was poetry.
My freedom withheld. How can I bear to talk about it? I look to see who is happy, but they only sit quietly. I am anxious and depressed and cannot fall asleep. The days are long and the bottle constantly empty.
140 Chinese poems were carved into the barracks' wooden walls, and they shared a common theme: sadness, misery, and humiliation. They revealed a forgotten past on the island. Before it was an army barracks, the building was a detention center for the island's immigration station in 1910, called the Ellis Island of the West. This bell sounded whenever a new ship of Chinese immigrants was approaching Angel Island in the early 1900s. They were met with officials who herded them into overcrowded detention barracks for interrogation. Immigrants lived in the barracks between 1 week to 2 years. Robert Fung is an Asian history professor at San Francisco State University. He says it was the first time a group was named by race to be excluded from coming into the country.
The Chinese Exclusion Act, written in 1882, said that if you're a Chinese, you if you're a Chinese laborer, you cannot come to America. You know, the law was made specifically to target the Chinese. It was later amended to make it even more restrictive because the view, the mythology of the Chinese was that they were here to take our jobs away, cheap labor competition.
It felt like a jail.
Lai Keng Wong arrived at Angel Island when she was just 7 years old. Her father was living in Oakland and sent for her and her sisters to come to America to receive an education, something that wasn't available to them in China.
I was traumatized because I told you about the locked doors, the bar windows, and the way the guards treated us. Whenever we wanted to talk, they would try to look at us. We were told what time to get up. We were told what time to eat. We were told what time to go to the bathroom. There was no such thing as a book available for us to read. There was no such thing as anything, like even little toys for kids to play with.
Conditions at the station were fit for unwelcome guests. Detainees like Lai Keng slept in thin metal triple bunk beds. They had to disrobe in groups of 30 for intimate medical exams. The doors were locked and guarded. The poems on the walls told countless stories.
Curled up in an enclosure, my movements are dictated by others. Enduring 100 humiliations, I can only cry in vain. This person's tears fall, but what can the blue heavens do?
You know, there's bars on the windows, you know, like where are they going to escape to?
Robert Fung.
It was exactly like a prison. Prison for being Chinese.
Hoping to save the barracks from demolition, Alex Weiss told his superiors about the poems. He says they weren't interested and told him they had other plans for the land. But Weiss says he's always believed there was another reason.
Maybe some of the higher-ups thought this was not a good story to tell because it was a story of racism and bad treatment of Americans to immigrants.
Weiss didn't take no for an answer. He and Lai Keng Wong joined Bay Area Chinese Americans to spearhead a vigorous public awareness campaign. That led to a 2000 California vote assigning $15 million for the preservation and restoration of the immigration station. A chain of federal, state, and private funds followed, taking it off the list of the 11 most endangered historic sites in America. The plan includes turning the barracks into a museum. Visitors will be able to see live reenactments of how immigrants were checked in and interrogated in the early 1900s.
The Chinese people and the people from the Far East have contributed just as much as the European immigrants who came through Ellis Island.
For those like Lai Keng Wong, who lived through the Angel Island experience, seeing the station restored is important, but it's not all positive for her. It brings back haunting memories like the ones expressed in the poems. Despite this, Lai Keng believes Americans still should know the truth about the Asian immigration experience, no matter how bleak that picture may be.
I visualize the United States as a very diverse country. And each strand in our flag will represent some segments of the different ethnic groups. And I feel very strongly if we pull out one of the strands, let's say the Chinese strand, it's no longer United States history.
And the immigration station and what I was able to spark is still one of my proudest achievements.
As for Ranger Weiss, he says he's proud to be a part of the movement that saved a crucial part of the American story.
We need to face our history, whether it's that honorable for us to some of the things we did and also some of the good things we did. So history is history. You can't just spin it to say it never happened.
The Barracks Museum is scheduled to open to the public in 2006.
That's Hannah Baba reporting from the former Angel Island Immigration Center in the San Francisco Bay. You're listening to Here and Now. Thank you. The Nobel Prize for Economics was awarded today to Americans Robert Owen and Thomas Schelling for their work on game theories, which help explain political and economic conflicts, but let's be honest, are not as intriguing as the effect of Star Wars films on the brains of locusts or research into the odors of stressed-out frogs. These strange but true scientific studies were honored recently in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at the 15th Annual Ig Nobel Awards. The scientific humor magazine Annals of Improbable Research came up with the idea. Editor Mark Abrams was master of ceremonies.
To fully explain and illustrate this year's theme, which I remind you is infinity, we have Nobel laureate Dudley Hirschbach, who will explain the concept of infinity.
It's a very simple concept, but you have to understand a lot of other concepts. You have to understand the concept of one, of two, of three, of four.
The Ig Nobel Prize for Literature this year is awarded to the Internet Entrepreneurs of Nigeria for creating and then using email to distribute a bold series of short stories, thus introducing millions of readers to a cast of rich characters, each of whom requires just a small amount of expense money so as to obtain access to the great wealth to which they are entitled and which they would like to share with the kind person who assists them.
This is how I live. OCD makes me be all obsessed and compulsive.
Miss Sweetie Poo is 8 years old. Miss Sweetie Poo, would you please demonstrate what you'll do when a speaker exceeds his or her allotted time?
Please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored.
Thank you, Miss Sweetie Poo.
Please stop.
Greg A. Miller of Oak Grove, Missouri, for inventing newticles, artificial replacement testicles for dogs. Benjamin Smith of the University of Adelaide, Australia, and of the University of Toronto, Canada, and to Yoji Hayasaka of the Australian Wine Research Institute for painstakingly smelling and cataloging the peculiar odors produced by 131 different species of frogs when the frogs were feeling stressed. John Mainstone and the late Thomas Parnell of the University of Queensland, Australia, for patiently conducting an experiment that began in the year 1927, in which a glob of congealed black tar has been slowly, slowly dripping through a funnel at a rate of approximately one drop every 9 years.
So if you take a piece of pitch and you smash it with a hammer, it certainly behaves like a solid material. Actually, it's a fluid. And so it will behave like a fluid.
Claire Rind and Peter Simmons of Newcastle University in the UK for electrically monitoring the activity of a brain cell in a locust while that locust was watching selected highlights from the movie Star Wars.
I needed to show the locust a huge variety of visual scenes to see what this neuron was really interested in. And what I found was that it was Darth Vader.
The Ig Nobel Prize in Nutrition is awarded to Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu of Tokyo, Japan. The award is for photographing and retrospectively analyzing every meal he has consumed during a period of 34 years and counting.
Please be patient before eating a meal. Take picture. Long life should be longer. Speech should be short.
And our trip to the Ig Nobels was produced by Vince Fairchild. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Singer-songwriter Michael Penn is intimately familiar with the movie business. Yes, he's that Penn, the brother of actors Sean and Chris and the son of actor-director Leo Penn and the actress Eileen Ryan. But Michael's path has been a musical one with several CD releases, including 1989's March, which had the top 40 hit No Myth. What if I was You also might remember Michael's voice from the soundtrack to the film I Am Sam. He covered the Beatles' song Two of Us with his wife Amy Mann.
Two of us riding nowhere, spending someone's hard-earned pay. You and me Sunday driving, not arriving on our way back home.
Michael Penn has also scored films, including the 1997 Boogie Nights, in which he took a small role. His latest work has also got a Los Angeles flair. The CD is titled Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947.
Singer-songwriter
Michael Penn joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Walter Reed, the Army Hospital?
Yes.
Just designated to be closed. We
yes.
wish we had that song then. I mean,
yes. I have a MySpace page, and one of my MySpace friends wrote a comment that said, you write a song about Walter Reed Memorial Hospital, and they close it 2 weeks later after your song's released. Will you now please write a song about the Bush administration? Which I thought was funny.
Little politics thrown in with the music for free. But what critics are saying that song is possibly about a failed relationship or possibly about a soldier coming home feeling that life had moved on without him. And I'm thinking those are sort of the same things.
Yeah, I mean, the position that I took on the album is I had, you know, written this batch of songs that for a variety of reasons I set. I mean, I don't want people to get the wrong idea. Clearly, I didn't write a swing album. But lyrically, I put all these songs in Los Angeles, but in Los Angeles in this particular period of history. Actually, the whole period of time between World War II, the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War, but particularly 1947, which was just such this incredible watershed year.
Why? Why for you was it, for all of us?
To me, it's the year that ushers in the times that we're living in now. For example, 1947, just as it relates to current events, 1947 was the year of the National Security Act, which meant the formation of the CIA, the formation of the NSC, the formation of the early trade agreements that became NAFTA and GATT and all of those things. There were all these incredible technological breakthroughs. It's the year that the transistor was invented, which obviously leads to computers. This is perhaps my favorite thing just because I have an Orwellian view of history. It's the year that what was once called the Department of War was renamed the Department of Defense.
Let's listen to a little of Transistor, again, another technological invention of that year. And it does feel like it, how it must have, I mean, I'm seeing black and white TVs, and let's listen. I want to ask you about your sounds. I mean, you've spoken a little of the politics and your thinking about that year. But we also know that you, from your biographies, that you were a huge Beatles fan. And that's what I'm feeling a little bit here, too, sort of a yellow submarine, but through this really, like a black and white prism.
Yeah, well, the Beatles were of my childhood, but my interest in music sort of came along almost more so from in the 70s, in the late 70s and into the 80s, and listening to things that were clearly very influenced by the Beatles. I mean, there was a band called Big Star that, you know how you find these bands when you're a kid that you sort of feel don't know, some kind of proprietary ownership mm-hmm. of, because nobody else knows about them at the time. And
mine was Orleans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, moving on. I'm back to your current CD. I want to listen to the song Mary Lynn, Turn Around Mary Lynn, and then ask you how this fits into okay. your concept.
I wanted some reminders in the record of America, and this to me was this sort of Appalachian kind of chant, which I just wrote actually on a dulcimer, and wanted to sort of ground the record at a certain point in more sort of traditional folk elements.
Yeah. You have said in interviews that the rest of the CD is, you know, in 1947, it's about a year, but it's also about a Los Angeles that doesn't exist anymore.
When I wrote these songs, and this often happens with me, as I'm writing, whether it's about my own life or about a friend's experiences or something that I've observed, I tend to sort of see it almost like a play in my head. And this time, you know, the cars were different. The streets were different. It was literally this sort of, you know, a much more Raymond Chandler version of Los Angeles than I grew up in.
Hmm. That's singer-songwriter Michael Penn speaking of his new CD called Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947. Michael, we recently had your wife Amy Mann on the program. She had her own new album, The Forgotten Arm, that tells the story of a boxer and his girlfriend through the course of their relationship. And I've been thinking, well, it must have been fun in the Penn Mann household with two, you know, concept albums being written at the same time. But I'm hearing that maybe you don't think this is a concept album.
My record, I actually don't look at as a concept album any more than any of my records. The emphasis for me is more that it's an album. Because now that we live in an iTunes MP3 world, it's about individual songs. And the other thing about an album as opposed to iTunes and MP3s is that an album has two distinct acts, two sides. And one of the things that's really annoying to me about the CD is you're presented with the potential of like 70 minutes of music at a single sitting, which is so overwhelming, and nobody wants to do that. Sides were these very manageable little chunks of music, and I have memories of like being really in the mood for side two of this album or side one of that album. And so I split the album up, in my head anyway, as two acts like that. And in fact, when I put out the advance of the record, just really because I'm a brat, I mastered the record as two tracks. Track one was all of side one, and track two was all of side two, which annoyed a lot of people, but there you go.
Singer-songwriter Michael Penn, he's talking about his new CD. It's called Mr. Hollywood Jr. 1947. It looks at, well, post-World War II, Los Angeles, through a musical lens. Michael Penn, thanks very much for coming in to tell us about it.
Thanks very much for having me.
Can't let go and can't hold on to.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Looking for a lifeline online, something to show that I really do know. So that's the
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.